Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Law, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Jeffrey Bristol, and I'm a host on the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Professor John Witte, Robert W. Woodruff Professor of Law, McDonald Distinguished Professor, and Center for the Study of Law and Religion Director at Emory University School of Law. He has written extensively about family and religious law. The Western Case for Monogamy Over Polygamy is a deeply researched book showcasing Professor Witte's knowledge and experience in the field of family and religious law. It traces the legal origins of European monogamy from the classical period to the present. Originally conceived as a brief for an advisory opinion to a Canadian court, Professor Witte transformed this argument into a work that not only explores the history of European marital law, but argues that monogamy is positive for society. It considers not just the legal, but also the moral and religious arguments for this institution. He joins us from Atlanta. So thank you, Professor Witte, for joining us today at New Books Network, the Law Channel. I certainly hope the weather in Atlanta is warmer than it is here in Michigan.
I suspect it is, and it's good to be here, and I'll bring warm greetings from the South to you and your listeners.
All right, that's great. We'll appreciate it. We were actually up here. We had an unusually warm last week, but I think we're getting some revenge this time. So we're here talking about your book, The Western Case for Monogamy Over Polygamy, and it's a wonderful read, very detailed, extremely detailed, in fact, definitely an accomplishment of scholarship. So
thank you.
The first thing that I think is interesting is, usually when you have an academic book, it has a very neutral title. This title, however, kind of stakes a position before one begins the book. And I suspect that comes from the kind of interesting backstory behind its authorship. So I was wondering if you could please tell us how you came to write this book and why does it have such a provocative title?
Yeah, thank you. I've been writing on the history of marriage and family, sexuality, children, children's rights in the Western tradition for 30-odd years. And on the strength of that work, I was invited by the Canadian Attorney General to give an expert opinion in a reference case, in effect, an advisory opinion that the British Columbia Supreme Court was engaged in, raising the question about whether the traditional prohibition on polygamy inherited from the English common law and in place in Canadian law since the later 19th century, was still constitutional under the new Charter of Rights in Canada, under basic international human rights norms. And my task was to sit down on behalf of the Attorney General and to write out, such as I could, the Western story about how monogamy had been privileged over polygamy and what were some of the grounds for the historical prohibitions against polygamy in the civil law, common law, canon law traditions. And so my brief was already charged with a bit of a normative push. And unlike some of the work that I've done on the history of marriage and family and sexuality in the past, I thought it best to retain that posture as I sat down to write the book. And my thought was that with the emerging issues surrounding same-sex marriage and then the other forms of plural marriage that might be considered and were indeed being considered and bandied about at the same time, I thought it apt to sit down and say, well, here's a Western story about monogamy versus polygamy. Let's give each side its due, and let me describe what the Western tradition has said about why it is privileged monogamy over polygamy to date.
Yeah. So what exactly was the case of controversy about in Canada? Could you give us a description of kind of just the general details?
Yeah. So it wasn't a case in controversy. Canadian law, constitutional law included, allows for, in effect, advisory opinions. And this is what they call a reference case. And the issue in the case was an open question, not driven by any particular facts, about whether Section 293 of the Criminal Code could still be maintained. It had been enforced against various Muslim emigres, against the fundamentalist Latter-day Saints group in Bountiful British Columbia and other groups, but it was not their case that was being adjudicated. It was the general reference question about whether the Section 293 prohibition could still stand, regardless of what arguments had been made on the other side. And that became an invitation for any group that had an interest for or against the maintenance of that traditional criminal prohibition to weigh in. And a wide variety of parties wrote briefs and offered expert testimony on behalf of the Attorney General, but also on behalf of a variety of groups that were interested in alternative positions on plural marriage.
Yeah, great. That's plural marriage and polygamy has obviously been on a lot of people's minds with same-sex marriage and whatnot. It's actually kind of interesting. My own work, for my dissertation in anthropology, I'm looking at how American Muslims use and understand Islamic law, and I actually came to that question as a result of polygamy. I originally was working in Mauritania, and it's kind of an interesting situation there where non-Salafist fundamentalist Muslims do not practice polygamy, and Salafist Muslims do, for various reasons that led me to believe that Muslims in the United States should also practice polygamy. And so, you know, that's kind of what brought me into it here in the States. Particularly, my wife was also getting very interested in, you know, kind of these fundamentalist Mormon stories at the same time, which kind of sparked my imagination.
Yeah, and I think what your experience underscores is that it's not a one size fits all in terms of talking about Muslim polygamy. It doesn't take nearly a nuanced enough approach to both the teachings of the Quran and the Hadith and the wide diversity in the very diverse Muslim world out there on marriage and family and sexuality questions. And it also underscores that the fundamentalist Latter-day Saints are one splinter group from mainline Mormon or Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints groups, which have renounced polygamy since 1906 and have made it an excommunicable offense. So there's division within religious communities, and one has to be careful about simply talking about all Muslims are polygamists, all Mormons are polygamists, all Vietnamese Hmong are polygamists. And I think your experience helps underscore that for the average reader and listener.
Yeah, and it's fascinating because you can see through your description of the history some of these same debates taking place in Western Christianity. I joke around with my wife because, like I said, her kind of interest in the media side of this got me interested in my dissertation topic, but she is herself a Mennonite, old Mennonite family with some distant relatives who are Amish. And I think I always tease her because they have an interesting relationship with polygamy themselves. So maybe to lead into that, I was wondering if you could tell us what is the history briefly of polygamy and monogamy in the Western or European tradition?
How many hours do we have? So the brief history is that the Hebrew Bible countenances polygamy and recognizes that in cases of starvation, famine, death of one's married brother, and other instances, that polygamy is permissible and sometimes even mandatory. Monogamy is the norm. Two in one flesh is the starting teaching of Genesis, but there's a recognition in Jewish law of polygamous options. And leading patriarchs, Abraham, Jacob, David, Solomon, take polygamy as a norm and an expectation, in part as a form of spiritual and political power and economic power, in part as a way of ensuring offspring. And those patterns built into the Hebrew Bible become the sources in which intermittently in the history of the Western tradition, we see Jews and various Christian splinter groups intermittently practice it. The normative position taken by Greek law and Roman law already in the 5th century BCE and maintained powerfully after the 3rd century of the Common Era is that polygamy is not permissible. And after the 3rd century, it becomes criminal. And after the 9th century, it becomes a capital crime. And in much of the West from the 9th to the 19th century, it remains a capital crime. Intermittently, we see experiments with polygamy in the Western Christian tradition. There are certain splinter groups in the first millennium. There are a few experimenters in the 12th and 13th century, Anabaptist groups, as you say, in the 16th century, occasional freethinkers in the 17th and 18th century, Mormons, Native American Indians, Chinese emigres in the 19th century, whose practice in polygamy is initially noted and then increasingly harshly treated by the authorities in application of their criminal law. And the tests of that constitutionally in the United States have been gave rise to the famous set of cases, six in number, from 1879 to 1890, where the U.S. Supreme Court repeatedly rejoined arguments that there was a free exercise right to practice polygamy. Court repeatedly held for the federal government, which had criminalized it both directly and indirectly. The case, there are no more Supreme Court cases after 1946, which largely repeat that same provision of 1879 to 90. And lower federal courts and almost all state Supreme Courts have been consistent in insisting that the crime of polygamy is appropriate to put in place, and various kinds of liberty interests to the contrary, including religious liberty interests, have been unavailing.
Yeah, and that's a great question, because it raises issues of polygamy and the changing definition of marriage, particularly in the context of same-sex marriage, which I want to circle back to towards the end of the interview. But one of the things that I've always been interested in is the Jewish path to monogamy. I think it makes a certain amount of sense, again, from an anthropological perspective, that you had, you know, Christianity come to monogamy as a result of the Greek and Roman preference for that. But Semitic peoples, as we see with Islam, were practitioners of polygamy themselves for a long time. So what happens to, how does Judaism come to a monogamous solution, or does it?
Yeah, so it the short answer is in 1130, a rabbinic decree of Gershon makes polygamy a violation of halakha. But it has to be said that notwithstanding biblical precedents and early Talmudic statements permitting polygamy, polygamy is always a minority practice, a decided minority practice, pre and post diaspora in Judaism. It is always predicated on the capacity of the man to support more than one wife. In a number of rabbinic interpretations, it turns on the consent of the first or subsequent wives before bringing another into the household. And it comes with rights of divorce and provision both in and after divorce for a wife who's dismissed. The pressure that Jews faced in the course of the first millennium first came from Roman law, which insisted for all members of the empire after the third century that the practice of polygamy is impermissible. Narrow exceptions were carved out for a couple of small Jewish communities, but only at a massive cost of gold and silver paid in tribute. By the 6th and 7th centuries in Roman law, Byzantine law, and the various Germanic laws, especially Spanish law, there's increased pressure on the Jews to abide by the monogamous ideals, both of traditional Roman law and of Christian theology. That pressure persists throughout the last part of the first millennium and into the early part of the second. And Western-based Jewish communities ultimately shrunk the permissible practices of polygamy, and then ultimately, as I indicated in 1130, rebuked it as a practice. Jews scattered in the Middle East outside the domain of Western authorities, including eventually the Ottoman Empire, continued intermittently to practice polygamy. Karaite Jews in particular maintained this as a matter of biblical law rather than Talmudic law. But the practice largely fell into desuetude among Western Judaism.
One of the things that you mention in your book, rightly, is that polygamy, we use that term often maybe overly simplistically, right? Polygamy can be divided, one, it can be divided into two broad things, polygyny, the having of multiple wives, and polyandry, the having of multiple husbands. But in your book specifically, you discuss the nuances of polygamy within the Christian tradition and indicate that it's not just an issue of polygyny, that there are, in fact, different kinds of polygamy. I was wondering if you could just very quickly kind of outline what different forms of polygamy have existed in Christian thought.
Yeah, in Christian thought and Christian law as well. One is what is called serial polygamy or digamy, the party's repeated remarriage after the ending of a prior marriage by death or by divorce. That was stigmatized already in the first millennium and became increasingly problematic in the second. Often the term serial polygamy or digamy was attached to that. Then there were other forms of what were in effect called constructive or interpretive polygamy. When a party is married to one and engaged to another, or vice versa, when a party is engaged to two parties, to two fiancés concurrently, that gets extended using biblical prototypes to think about the marriages between two sisters or engagements to two sisters concurrently, not between, but two sisters concurrently, or a seriatim, or even engagement to one and marriage to another. So different forms of multiple commitments, concurrent or seriatim, became the way of thinking about it. And there's one other big category in canon law, the law of the church, called clerical bigamy. And clerical bigamy or polygamy was focused on the desire to ensure that any ordained cleric who is required to be celibate for the rest of his life had at most only one wife or fiance before. And if he had more than one wife, or he had a fiance and an engagement broken off and then a wife, his eligibility for ordained office had expired. And when he persisted in that pursuit of ordination, he was called a clerical bigamist or clerical polygamist. There were some clergy that were married and doubly married, in fact, but the technical term of clerical bigamy is focused on the narrow question of whether you had more than one ongoing marital or quasi-marital relationship.
Now, and were all these concerns, these different kinds of polygamy, concerned simultaneously? It seemed to me reading the book that there are kind of short stretches of time where, particularly like during the Reformation, during the founding of new communities like Mormonism, where simultaneous polygamy becomes a bigger concern, and other times where the concern really is serial polygamy.
Yeah. So the throughout the Roman Empire and thereafter, what was called real polygamy or the polygamy concurrent marriage to two or more spouses, that remained a perennial concern of the secular authorities, and intermittently gets prosecuted, but remains a crime on the books. And to the extent we have records, we see that it gets repeatedly enforced. And when there are experiments with real polygamy, the numbers of prosecutions increase, but there is a consistent pattern of scoundrels that have wives in two different cities, if they're traveling merchants, or people that simply walk away from their marriage, move down the road and get married again. Those folk always do get prosecuted. The periodic involvement of the church in that comes in the 12th and 13th century, when the church is consolidating its understanding of marriage as a two-in-one flesh, enduring exclusive, modeled on Christ's relationship with his church. And there we see the church getting rather actively involved in both real polygamy and then a much more aggressive pursuit of these other forms of constructive polygamy as well as clerical bigamy. In the 16th century, clerical bigamy falls aside in Protestant lands. Concerns for constructive polygamy are reduced, but there's a real focus again on prosecuting real polygamy. It has to be said, from the 17th century to the 21st century in the West, it's only the technical canon law of the Catholic Church that continues to be worried about constructive polygamy and clerical bigamy. The focus increasingly in secular law thereafter is on what we've called real polygamy, whether polyandry or polygyny, but polygyny is the main form.
And I think that's very interesting. What's happening there? Why is the church becoming less concerned with the constructive elements of polygamy?
Well, the Catholic Church remained concerned about it. And I said, the canon law picks this up in its own enforcement of internal sexual morality for Catholic faithful and Catholic clergy. Protestants don't think that these some of these forms of constructive polygamy are in fact improper. Clerical bigamy they think to be unnecessary and indeed an insult to the gift of marriage that God has given to all people, clerical and lay alike, and they think it appropriate and indeed encourage strongly clergy to be married, regardless of how many times they've been married before. If the prior marriage was properly dissolved by death or divorce or annulment, a cleric can and should be married. It was viewed as inappropriate to be doubly engaged or engaged to one and married to another, but that was viewed as a deserving of civil sanction, but in large measure, the concern was to maintain and retain the one licit or valid marriage that was there and to make the party faithful to that valid marriage going forward. And punishment, especially execution, was considered to be harmful to the actually properly married spouse and the children and other dependents. Some of the other forms of constructive marriage, especially serial polygamy, turned on an understanding of whether remarriage was appropriate. And Protestants generally across the board thought that remarriage was not only appropriate, but sometimes a better thing to do than to retain widowhood or divorced status for fear of putting that widowed divorced party in an impossible position sexually. And they would succumb to temptation of having non-marital sexual relations. Better to let them get remarried, having tasted the pleasures of marriage and family life and the marital bed.
Yeah, it seems interesting to me that one of the other undercurrents I noticed is this debate about the possibility of celibacy between the Catholic Church and the Protestants, where the Protestants seem, I don't know, we could call it more realistic or more pessimistic, I guess, depending on your perspective about the ability of individuals to remain celibate. They were pessimistic about that. Whereas the Catholic Church seems more optimistic, to put more emphasis on the ability of the laity and the clergy themselves to restrain their sexual impulses.
Yes, I think that's right.
So one of the other things that I was thinking as I was reading this book, you have an earlier book. If I hopefully I can get the title correct, I believe it's Marriage from Sacrament to Contract. And I was, it struck me that there might be a connection between these two works in terms of serial polygamy and thinking about the increased permissiveness of divorce and the reduction of serial polygamy in terms of marriage moving from a concern, a public concern and a concern of the church, to marriage being viewed as a more of a contractual relationship between individual parties.
Yeah, and I guess the interim step between that, which is I try to document at some length in the book called From Sacrament to Contract, Religion, Law, and Marriage in the Western Tradition. What I try to document is the place in between sacrament and contract, like a sacramental view of marriage in the High Middle Ages, which emphasizes the enduring exclusive relationship between the man and the woman, an emulation of the relationship between Christ and his church, and that enduring relationship being permanent, divorce not being permissible, the marriage ending only with the death of one of the two spouses, and remarriage being strongly discouraged and sometimes outright prohibited by the canon law of the church, thinking that that would impugn the integrity and the sanctity of the sacramental marriage that's been enjoined. Protestants of various stripes, Lutherans, Calvinists, Baptist, Anabaptists, Anglicans, but especially Lutherans and Calvinists, focus on the fact that marriage is not a sacrament like baptism or the Eucharist. Marriage is instead a social estate. Marriage is a covenant union predicated on models of covenant in the scripture. But those relationships are by their nature conditional performance contracts. And it's important that the marital union achieve the goods that it is created to achieve, procreation and mutual companionship and mutual protection from sin, and fidelity and loyalty and all the other things that goods that were ascribed to it. And when a marriage fails in its fundamental purposes, because it can't, natural condition, or because one of the parties betrays it through adultery or divorce or adultery or malicious desertion or habitual cruelty or refusal to discharge basic conjugal duties, the thought is the marriage is over, and divorce is the means by which both parties are released from their conditional performance covenant and permitted then to start anew. And remarriage is the mechanism whereby one starts anew. And it's very clear that as you move to a different understanding of the nature of marriage from sacrament to something a little lower flying in the form of covenant or social estate, let alone private contract, you open up a posture in theology and in law for an understanding that divorce and remarriage are natural parts of the process, even if not steps that are taken lightly or without procedural safeguards. And because of that, the widened definition of polygamy that emerges in the course of the High Middle Ages, 12th through 15th century, becomes much more muted in 16th and 17th century Protestant circles.
So I think that raises the question, given that so much of, it seems like from the book, so much of the legal action at a certain period of time was concerned with this serial polygamy, what does the historical experience of polygamy and the arguments against it have to say in terms of informing our own beliefs about marriage practice today?
The preoccupation with serial polygamy clearly is medieval and early modern preoccupation that doesn't persist in the 19th and 20th century, even in Catholic and Protestant circles. In Protestant circles, we have an increasing recognition that fault-based divorce and eventually no-fault divorce are permissible things theologically to contemplate, and it allows for parties to start afresh. On the Catholic side, and this is controversial to say, but on the Catholic side, de facto divorce begins increasingly to creep in through an aggressive annulment practice, an annulment practice that leaves parties back in the status quo ante and lets them marry anew, not on as a form of remarriage, but on the sometimes reality, sometimes fiction of the prior marriage being null and void and therefore non-existent. So I do think that the tradition has come to realize that marriage is not an idol to be worshipped or a halter to be permanent, locking a person into uncomfortable and sometimes dangerous relationships. It instead is a means to the end of a good, domestic good. And the goods of procreation and fidelity and loyalty and protection, mutual caring and sharing have to be achieved in the institution. And if they can't be, it's important to give parties an opportunity to start afresh.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And so given that marriage is such an evolving institution, and I would incidentally, as a Catholic, I would actually, my personal experience and the experience of my family, I think, echoes what you said about an aggressive annulment practice. Been some annulments I've seen that I don't know that I would necessarily, if I were the bishop, have granted them. But I think there's definitely an attempt to kind of reconcile the strictness of a lack of divorce procedure in the church with the basic realities today. And so you mentioned the same-sex marriage issue as kind of putting some of these questions of polygamy into play. And What does same-sex marriage have to do with polygamy in our society today? And why has the issue of same-sex marriage seemed to open a potential door to the question of polygamy?
Yeah, so at the generic level, if the basic form of the marital union recognized at law is open for amendment or renegotiation, the thought is that if you consider a heterosexual monogamous marriage to be under-inclusive of the right to marry, and now same-sex marriage is permissible as well. And the logic for that is liberty, equality, self-determination. It becomes harder to resist a next step, which would say, well, if we're pluralizing the understanding of the marital form this way, why can't we pluralize it with other forms of marriage, including plural polygyny, polyandry, pentagamy, and other kinds of plural union. And the thought is, if the state is going to hold increasingly diverse off-the-rack models of something called the marital household, why shouldn't we just add an additional one? So that's one piece of it. And if we're shaking the foundations of an institution 2,500 years old in the West, question is, what else then is permitted once that crack opens? Second is that since the 70s, indeed, already in some of the Woodstock documents, but certainly since the early 1970s, folks that have advocated for what were then called homosexual or gay rights had both same-sex marriage and polygamous marriage as part of their platform. And in the early advocacy for same-sex marriage, polygamy was often a rider in those conversations. Other kinds of more exotic forms of sexual association were less considered, but those two often went hand in hand. And in the first 20 odd years of the same-sex marriage debate, same-sex marriage and polygamous marriage were the two things that were being pressed together. Polygamy fell aside in that eventual advocacy of this for legislative change and ultimately for judicial change. But it was part of the package initially.
Why do you think that the polygamous part of that package fell aside?
It's deeply unpopular in the Western tradition. It was hard to garner as much sympathy for it. I think it was a strategic move that this was a liability rather than a help in pushing for marital equality for same-sex parties. There is increasing difficulty in trying to engineer cases or sympathetic legislative agendas. The people, and I only know this casually from talking to a few people anecdotally and reading a little bit of the literature, there was a strategic move made in the late 1980s and early 1990s to simply say polygamy is too old, it has too old of a and longstanding a prejudice against it that we are harming the same-sex marriage cause or the same-sex equality cause by trying to drag it along with us.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point.
I'll just finish that point. The West's prohibitions on polygamy are ancient. They go back 2,500 years. The West's concerns about same sex, about sodomy, are by comparison much more recent. Yeah, they're 1,000 years old rather than 2,500 years old. But it's interesting how big a difference that is in terms of the popular and professional stigma that attaches to polygamy still today, and certainly back in the 1980s and early 90s by comparison to same-sex parties. Polygamy was viewed as foreign. It was what other exotic cultures did. It was a boundary line between Western civilization and non-Western civilization. Nobody was making that a comparable claim historically or in the 80s about same-sex intimacy.
Does that just mean, do you think that same-sex or polygamy, is an issue whose time hasn't come that might come up in the future, and that the main arguments that are really powerful against polygamy are simply ones of palatability, or are there other arguments that we might make today against it? I know in the book you try to separate the concern for the two, and you definitely come down on the side of monogamy over polygamy. So I was wondering what your thoughts on that were.
Yeah, so I do think, in answer to the first part of your question, that the issue is going to come up, and indeed it has begun to come up already. It's part of the push to the democratization of desire, if you will. It's part of a recognition that marital household construction is a matter of self-determination, that a harm-based logic may obtain in some cases, but not all cases. And there is I think it's inevitable that in the next generation, we're going to start seeing strong cases being brought before Western courts. And there are a trickle of them now. I think there's going to be a growing number of them in subsequent years. The reality is that the case for polygamy has been stymied in the post 9/11 world because polygamy and Islam are often linked, and this is just viewed as backdoor catering to Western sympathy by some, at least. It does not help that the Mormon Church has been increasingly strident in its anti-polygamy stature or posture, in terms of having sympathy for the fundamentalist Latter-day Saints Church. But I do think the arguments are going to mount. I think the legislatures and judiciaries around the country are going to, and around the West, are going to face these things. Federalism actually may, in this instance, make for local experimentation, and the kind of neo-federalism of the last 20-odd years we may find individual states or counties beginning to experiment with this in a way that eventually trickles into broader reforms. Not sure. You're left with, and one final thing is that globalization, independent of Muslim emigres and what we now think about them in some of the popular xenophobic rhetoric, globalization is going to bring more and more polygamous communities to the West, and it's going to be harder and harder to continue to make insistence of monogamy a condition for naturalization status as it is now. So the arguments they're left with are, okay, tradition, that's not a particularly strong argument, although it carries some weight. Harm to women, harm to children, harm to spouses, worries about the harm to the polity by giving religious communities unusual power over the domestic sphere. Those are arguments that work in the general case. They don't always work in the specific case. And when a case comes forward that has no harm, it's going to be harder to press those arguments. One of the enduring concerns is recognizing the importance of providing marital opportunities for the roughly equal numbers of men and women in the community. Not sure that argument is going to carry so much weight anymore with so many single parties. So that the case, the historical case, which was rooted in theological argument and had utilitarian calculus left to it, now devoid of theological argument and only utilitarian calculus that can carry the day constitutionally, is going to be harder and harder to maintain. And you're left with the harm arguments and tradition arguments and symbolism arguments being the only ones that are going to continue to be pressed in legislatures and courts.
Yeah, that's, it's interesting. There's a study, I think, that I read not too long ago that was indicating that Senegal and I think certain parts of Africa had seen for the first time last year or the year before an increase in polygamous marriages after a decline of many decades. And Indonesia, I think, was another place where they've seen an increase in polygamous marriages. But it's strange, in my own research among American Muslims, I have noticed a pretty strict bifurcation similar to the lines I saw in Mauritania, where immigrant Muslims who move to the United States tend to overwhelmingly be opposed to polygamy, at least the more educated ones, which makes most of the Muslim immigrants are more educated. And they, in part because they view it as not prohibited according to Islamic law in theory, but there's a law of the land argument, and they seem almost morally opposed to it as well, although they don't mention that for obvious reasons. Where you do see polygamy in the United States among American Muslims, and Deborah Majid has an excellent book on this, Islamic Polygamy, is among African-American converts who make the same argument that the Salafists I knew in Mauritania did, which basically goes along the lines of most people prohibit polygamy through the marriage contract, but the marriage contract is a legal instrument created by two parties. The Quran gives the husband arguably unilateral rights to polygamy, and therefore the contract can't abrogate the Quran, which is a higher authority. But it's interesting, you can see these debates happening even here within communities, and sometimes it doesn't line up the way one might necessarily think it would.
Yeah. Yeah, so a couple comments. One is the there are pockets of the very diverse and widely dispersed Muslim world where we do see increases in polygamous practice. The polygyny belt in Central Africa is a notable one. Kenya, 2 or 3 years ago, allowed for a polygamous option. And in parts of Africa where the children are important to have as part of a labor pool, part of a status marker, and where high incidences of infant mortality and child mortality are regrettably normal part of life, we do see a greater practice. The difficulty of being an unattached woman in a set of communities that does not have a welfare state, does not have a robust form of diaconal relief, being part of a household is really critical for survival. And so there are a number of factors that would suggest in the Muslim and non-Muslim worlds of Central Africa that the practice of polygyny persists and is indeed going up. But you're right, in many parts of the Muslim world where especially there is Western influence, but also greater education, greater economic opportunity, a less dependence on a labor economy, there seems to be a dramatic decrease in the last years of polygamous households and appetite for polygamy. And there seems to be some debate, too, in the in Islamic jurisprudence about the propriety or impropriety of those couple of texts in the Quran and Hadith that permit this. The preemptory power of the Quran to override the contract, I mean, it's being preempted by a permission, not being preempted by a command. And the question then becomes, well, what do you do as a faithful Muslim as you contemplate the marital contract? Some would say you have to at least build into the contract the permission of multiple wives. Others would say you're permitted to put in the contract the provision for multiple wives, but you don't have to. And I've seen both those arguments get played out by authentic Muslim jurists, as far as I can tell them from afar. So there's an interesting diversity in practice and belief. The Bailey and Kaufman book on polygamy around the world documents a pretty dramatic decrease in the practice of polygamy in various parts of the world, including the Muslim world. And as you say, that replicates itself in Western countries where Muslims have emigrated, especially the last couple of generations.
Yeah, it raises an interesting similarity to some of the debates over the law of slavery in Islamic law, which, you know, is also abrogated by cultural practice, but of course, because it's revealed in theory, remains legally legitimate. But I always have to prevent myself from going down the hole of Islamic law, since it's part of my specialty. So bringing us back to the United States and American constitutional law, something you mentioned earlier kind of piqued my interest. You said, and this might maybe I'm asking you to put on your legal prognostication hat, which is maybe a little dangerous, but you mentioned that.
Prophets are without honor.
Yeah, right. But you mentioned the possibility of kind of experiments, of the federal experiments. You know, the idea, this is an old idea that the states allow, you know, different, one state can have one set of laws, the other state, another state can have another set of laws. And so you get these natural experiments in government. But I think that's an appealing idea, but what we saw with Obergefell was a tendency when, you know, a natural or human rights argument becomes involved to kind of stamp down on this idea of federalism and say, well, if we're going to recognize, one state is going to recognize, or a large enough group is going to recognize this as a particular right, then we can't leave it up to the states to conduct the experiment as it were. So what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's the, we're dealing with a couple of different things. One is federalism, what within family law should be left to the individual states to sort out in accordance with their own state constitutions and traditions, and what should be a matter of federal constitutional law under equal protection and due process guarantees. And as you know, since Griswold, we have a powerful new constitutional overlay on what had been an organic process of individual states doing their family law reform one by one. In the old days, for example, with the introduction, say, of no-fault divorce, we saw the introduction of no-fault divorce in 1969. I think it was California or New York. And then gradually over the next generation and state by state, that was picked up as an appropriate thing to add to the grounds for divorce, and the became a rather natural consensus by the later 1980s. Same thing in the same-sex marriage area. It's not like Obergefell came out of the blue. Obergefell stepped into a process that some would say should have naturally gone on for a generation or two further, from the early Bear case and from the Massachusetts Goodrich case and others, where states were experimenting with civil union, domestic partnership, and even same-sex marriage, and gradually beginning to recognize that as an off-the-rack option for their citizens. The natural federalism process would have said, let's let that go on for another generation or more before being sealed by federal constitutional law. Some would say Obergefell was a necessary catalyst to get the rest of the states online, given the reaction of defensive marriage acts, both at state and at the federal level. Others would say it was a constitutional imposition on a process that would more naturally have gone on and probably been more widely accepted if it had spent another generation getting state legislatures and state Supreme Courts to weigh in. My own view is that the issue of polygamy is showing, at least initially, the kind of incremental federalist, one state and county at a time approach, as we see in Utah now with the Brown v. Berman case that for the first time questions the constitutionality of the polygamy prohibition in Utah. We're beginning to see a number of state attorney generals who have said, declared publicly that we are not going to use state resources to prosecute the crime of polygamy in our states, and we're watching the incremental process again. A country of diverse and at last now divided as we are, sometimes the Supreme Court has to weigh in and speak, universal law for the community. It was thought that LGBTQ rights and identity and equality demanded that the Supreme Court speak. I don't see the Supreme Court having the same agitation toward it or appetite for doing the same thing with respect to the plural marriage partners.
There certainly seems like there needed to be a certain kind of critical mass in order to push the same-sex marriage issue to the Supreme Court and to general acceptance. And I think it's kind of interesting thinking about the difference between the two. You know, there's always a debate about the origin of homosexuality and its arguable, arguable biological, whether it's, whatever that means, cause. And certainly it seems harder to make the argument with polygamy that, there is some aspect of me cognitively, genetically, whatever it may be, that causes me to wish to have multiple spouses.
Yes.
So I think it's interesting along those lines to see whether we will get the same kind of critical mass development with polygamy that we got with same-sex marriage.
Yeah. So, I mean, I do think the reality that people began to experience in their own families, that sexual desire, sexual attraction, sexual partnering wasn't just whimsical, that it was rooted somehow in nature or inclination or a person's inherited or early acquired habits. That clearly helped the argument for a sympathetic ear to liberty, equality, self-determination, domestic autonomy. And you're right that there's nothing comparable to that in the natural foundation for polygamy. I mean, the natural foundation for polygamy is that there is in human nature an appetite for promiscuity that we acquire from our animal cousins or prototypes or whatever you want to call them, and that men in particular have, if unschooled, appetites for having and holding multiple females at once in a way that data show females don't, although that's not true of all. It's hard to credit that natural appetite and add it to the arguments for equality, liberty, and self-determination and have a sympathetic ear for it. It's a different kind of natural argument from nature.
So the last question...
That wasn't a felicitous distinction, but I think what I'm trying to say is that everybody could experience the by empathetically both experience and appreciate the same-sex desires of members of their community, members of their household, members of their family, and on the strength of that, find more powerful their arguments from equality, liberty, and self-determination. There's nothing comparable to that in experience so far with the polygamists.
So with that, we're winding up our time together. So I was wondering if you could tell us whether you're continuing this project or what other projects you have that we could look forward to reading.
You're kind to ask. This is, my wife will tell you as a matter of command that this is the last thing I'm going to be writing about marriage and polygamy. She got sick and tired of hearing about it for 3 years at the supper table, and God bless her for putting up with it. I have a big fat book in press now, should be out in a couple of months, called Church, State, and Family, Reconciling Traditional Teachings and Modern Liberties. It's coming out with Cambridge in March or April 2019. And that's my swan song in this field of marriage, family, sexuality, which I indicated I've been writing in for 30-odd years. And I'm trying there to say that in all our roiling debates about same-sex marriage and about same-sex bathrooms and cake shops and other things, and removing tax exemption from religious communities that don't consecrate same-sex marriages or recognize them and the like, for all of our roiling about that, which is healthy and appropriate, what we need to think more deeply about is the whole sexual field. And the marital field, and to take more a broader view and get out of the trenches of the culture wars about same-sex marriage and think more broadly about the range of things from sexuality, promiscuity, teenage pregnancy, concern for children's rights, ways of rethinking youth formation in a increasingly post-marital or extramarital culture, resources for education and charity for the disenfranchised, finding constructive ways of rethinking some of the wisdom of the Western tradition, including especially the Western Christian tradition, and trying to reconcile that with the realities of modern liberty, equality, and domestic autonomy, which we cherish and which have been hard won. And I spend some time in the book walking through the church fathers, Chrysostom and Augustine, Aquinas and Vittoria, Luther and Calvin, some of the great Enlightenment liberals and their surprising endorsement of traditional marriage and family life, looking at a model of integrated understanding of the marital sphere, and then walking through issues of children's rights, of plural marital jurisdictions, thinking about what role faith-based family law can play in liberal democracies, fussing with the polygamy and same-sex marriage distinctions that we've talked about a bit, and then trying to address respectfully but critically the new push for the disestablishment or abolition of marriage as a legal category, and then a swan song that trumpets the importance of maintaining a traditional marital family in a advanced liberal culture, even if that traditional marital family now includes same-sex marriage.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. It's a kind of a return to first principles, it sounds like, which I'll look forward to reading. Hopefully we can have you on again when it's published.
It would be a joy to do that. I've enjoyed this conversation. I'm interested in your story too, with anthropology and law coming together. You'll have some interesting work ahead of you, and I'll be intrigued to hear that and see what the what your dissertation yields.
All right, great. Well, hopefully I'll be able to tell you. All right, so thank you for joining us today, and I wish you the best of luck. Thanks for listening to New Books in Law, a podcast channel on the New Books Network.